who buckles first, the consumer or the grocer that starts driving prices down? You know, does the consumer walk away first and the grocers go panic and start driving prices down to compete? What's going to happen first?
Well, I mean, the easy answer for you, George, over the last, I would say, decade has been the grocer, because they've been bullying the supply chain for a very long time. Basically, grocers have seen themselves as the protector of citizens, really, when it comes to food affordability in Canada. In the U.S., it's not the same, because you don't have an oligopoly in the U.S. You have many regional players distorting those oligopolistic powers that you may find from Walmart or Kroger, or it's just not the same. In Canada, you basically have five major players dictating what we eat every single day. And so to get coordinated it's a very easy thing to do. So what has happened in the last 5-10 years, if Walmart was asked by, say, I don't know, General Mills, that they need to pay 10% more for their cereal or whatever they're trying to sell, they'll say, no way. And by the way, I need to charge you more fees because you're doing business with me. And if you don't deliver on time, I'll penalize you for it. And so Walmart was doing the bulldozing, and in behind them was Loblaw, Metro, and everyone else. That was going on and it got worse with COVID, which surprised me. I actually thought at the very beginning of COVID, people were working together. There was some harmony. They were helping each other out. Suppliers were helping grocers. It was really from March to May, I would say, it was beautiful. But in June, boom, Walmart comes in with new fees. Loblaw comes in with new fees. And that's when hell broke loose. And that's why it became this supply chain bullying situation became so public. It was out in the media. And frankly, George, I was shocked, completely shocked that it went to media, because it's such a unsexy, complicated topic for Canadians to understand. But it was out there and people got engaged. And so Walmart and Loblaws, had to listen. And that's why we're having this discussion around the code of conduct.
Well, and Michael Medline and Sobeys, either through pure doing good or brilliant strategy, knowing you're coming down the pipe, right? Let's get ahead of it. But that's done wonders, I think, to move this forward, to have someone of that size.
Michael Medline was brilliant, because he broke ranks. Okay, let's be honest here. But he knew what he was doing. He's number two.
As retailers entered the lockdown in March 2020, a small, diverse group of Canadian thought leaders gathered to virtually speculate, collaborate, and share their insights on the waves of disruption facing retailers. The Business of Retail podcast emerged as an unflinching strategic alternative to the conventional discourse, revealing challenges in the headlines and exploring new unconventional paths for all facets of the retail industry. Now, here's the panel.
Welcome to the Business of Retail. We have a returning speaker with Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, a food professor. If you want to find out a lot more about Sylvain, go back to episode 19, where we started off looking at food generally. We focused into food service. This time we're going to start at food and try and focus into food retail, and particularly looking at what's happening as we approach a post-pandemic era. What are the big trends and what are the interesting developments that may either help grocers and big food along, or actually stand in its way as a major obstacle for the industry to overcome. So I think it'd be helpful just to perhaps just get a snapshot of where we are with Sylvain, and we just start to beat a path towards what the future might look like.
Yeah, no, thank you for inviting me again. I really enjoyed our last session together. So when you invited me back, I said, absolutely. But we need to focus on one area. And I think all of us wanted to focus more on retail for obvious reasons. Last year was a bit of a party for grocers. It was easy money. Business came in all of a sudden. Of course, there were some disruptions that needed to be addressed, obviously, with the pressure coming from the outside, walking in, food service being closed for a while. Grocers had to really manage that shock, and they did very well. Sales went up dramatically. But since the start of 2021, there's a bit of a different normal that is happening, affecting grocers. And there's a couple of headwinds that I think we need to underscore. One, service is back. Obviously, restaurants are playing a much larger role in the economy. Before COVID, 35% of our money on food, our food money, was actually spent in service. That went down to 9%. Now it's up to about 29%. And so we're seeing really a sector recovering from last April of 2020. It was really devastating, but they'll be back. And we are expecting that 35% threshold to be reached by probably mid to end of 2022. The other headwind is our food prices. I mean, costs are going up. Before COVID, operating a grocery store was much cheaper for a few reasons. One, the cleanliness of stores wasn't really the same. So you need more support equipment, more labor probably. The other issue, of course, is labor itself, the costs and salaries. Salaries are going up in the sector. Grocers are under tremendous pressure to raise wages, and the average grocery store will employ somewhere between 80 to 100 people. If you raise salaries by, say, $1 or $2 an hour, which is kind of what's going on in some parts, that really impacts the bottom line of a grocery store, which typically would manage a net margin of anywhere between 1 to 1.5%, which is not a whole lot. And the other thing, of course, is the cost of food itself. If you see at the meat counter prices going up by 5, 7, 10%, not all of it goes into the pockets of grocery stores. They are actually paying more. It's impacting food services, but it's also impacting retail. The difference this time around compared to past years is that food inflation is actually impacting everything. And I'll give you one example: peanut butter. Peanut butter in Canada has been priced pretty much the same in the last 20 years. So if you go back 20 years in 2001, okay, a kilogram of peanut butter was basically the same price. Most Canadians don't know that, but it's the same price, except for this year. Peanut butter has gone up by 6% in Canada. So that, to us, that's a bit of a point of reference that tells you that's telling us everything is changing in the entire grocery store right now.
So digging under that, what is the source of the inflation? Is it that there's an inherent cost to supply chain with it being so disrupted last year that there's an effort made to get new sources and to aggregate maybe smaller supply? Or is there an inherent cost to the actual producers themselves that's going up?
I'd say there are two main factors. One, you just kind of mentioned it, logistics. Global logistics are more complicated. They're not as efficient. They're more costly. Moving anything around, if you know anyone in global logistics these days, they'll tell you it's expensive to move things around these days from one continent to the next. So that's one factor. The other factor is related to this quasi-ag commodity super cycle we're looking at, without oil participating, we're pretty much reliving what we saw back in 2008. Most commodities have gone up significantly. Look at canola, wheat, barley, corn. I mean, all of these ingredients are actually in many of the products we buy. And year to year, most of the commodities are up 50 to 80%. So at some point, something's got to give. Processors, General Mills, Procter & Gamble, Pepsi, all of these companies are paying more for their inputs. And eventually, those prices are being renegotiated in retail. And that's why prices are going up slowly. They're very careful not to spook consumers. They don't want to raise prices too high. They're looking at a runway of about 12 to 18 months to basically allow the market to adapt, because we all know that right now the market is still not only vulnerable but unpredictable. We don't know how much money people have to spend on food, really, because of real estate costs, because of the economy generally, who has jobs, like are they going to be back at work at some point? So there's a lot of unknowns right now, and that's why what I'm seeing right now is an entire supply chain being very careful not to spook that consumer in the end, because if you spook that person in the end, they ain't going to come back.
What happened in 08? How long did, are we seeing a permanent price increase in your future, or is it something that is more cyclical that, you know, it's going to be a couple of years, or what's your prognosis?
Yeah, if you recall, in 2008, that was the year when the barrel of oil was worth $147 US. Do you remember that? It was really unbelievable. And just like a little over 12 months ago, the barrel of oil was worth minus 37 US dollars. So, but back in 2008, everything was exploding. In those days, mutual funds, hedge funds, we're all looking at, they were looking for higher yields, and people were talking about the fuel, the food to fuel debate with ethanol, if you remember, because oil was so expensive, it just drove people towards commodities and look at commodity as a good source of fuel. And that really brought, let's say, a bushel of wheat at $9 US, which is still the record. And that affected the entire ethos of ag commodities in those days. Today, it's not the same thing, and it's not as pronounced, but still commodity prices are way up. So if farmers have enough moisture and can grow stuff, except like in BC where it's plus 20,000 degrees, if you're not dealing with a heat wave and you have moisture, you'll be making money as a farmer. But for the rest of us, it's going to be a little bit tougher.
Do you think that because of you wrote an article, I don't know, a month ago, or released an article about a month, 6 weeks ago, about the almost imbalance between our own in-country processing capability or capacity versus the US? And I think the figure I stuck in my mind, it was they've got like 26 times the processing capacity than we have in Canada. Normally it's 10 to 1, yep. tend to be a generic thing. It's part of the inflationary pressure. We make the stuff and then we add transport in it to get it to a processing plant. We pay somebody to process it, to transport it back into Canada, and we wonder why, is that an inflationary impact? And should we really, as an industry, be looking to support more local production, so it's local to market and local to maybe the source, so that we truncate that instead of going back, south of the border and north of the border, etc. We tend to perhaps look at an east to west kind of dimension to what we should be thinking about.
Absolutely, Gary. I mean, the less you can control processing, the more your entire chain is vulnerable to inflation. There's no doubt, because there are currencies at play. There's logistics, of course, and there's a lot of things you just can't control as a company. So as a country, if you don't really control that centerpiece, that very important strategic centerpiece, which is called processing, everything else is more complicated. But I'll give you one example of how the U.S. has done so well in processing versus Canada the last 10 years. So in the last 10 years in the U.S., okay, we've seen over 4,000 brand new food processing facilities being built. 4,000 in the last decade. In Canada, during that same time, about 4,000. So you see that the priority is completely different in the U.S. And that's why in food processing, the U.S. does very well, adding value to its own commodities, exporting, creating wealth for the ag sector. And of course, grocers in the end are in better shape because they don't really see their prices fluctuate all that much, except for produce. Produce is always an exception. But overall, when you look at the entire grocery store, like except maybe for dairy in the U.S. compared to Canada, Canada's dairy sector is very stable. But overall, prices are quite stable in the U.S.
You know, that was we were speaking to Arlene Dickinson recently on the podcast, and her new venture park, which is reassembling her different components of businesses, venture cap and marketing support. She's doubling down on Canadian food innovators. And that was one of her big messages, is we need to really build up our own ability, I think, as she would put it, to do pure farm to table as opposed to farm to a processor offshore back to our table. But I'm thinking, you know, if I'm a CEO listening to what you're talking about right now, then I'm probably listening mostly to my CFO around anything from exchange rate risk to any other kind of risk mitigation play that you need to put in with the commodity pricing that's fluctuating. And then I suppose my head of supply chain, which is how do we make sure we've got a more resilient supply chain that probably is still going to be, I'm guessing, Gary, still disrupted for a little while to come. I'm not hearing anything solved right now. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big believer in trades, but I'm also a big believer in smart trades too. It's hard to create wealth when you're only exporting frozen pork and cattle and wheat. I mean, we have to become more strategic about our focus to trades internationally. I mean, here we are in Canada talking about food security. We have so much to offer to the world. Going back to the Barton Report, which was actually tabled more than 5 years ago, I think. In the Barton Report, it mentions that Canada should be exporting well over $85 billion worth of agri-food products. You can't do that by exporting just bushels of wheat. You just can't do it. You have to think strategically about exports. And right now, we're basically at a quarter of that. We have so much potential. And the only way to do it is by building capacity around processing, which is why I'm very, very supportive and hopeful when I see a super cluster like Proteins Industries Canada out west. Protein Industries Canada is a super cluster creating a network of companies to foster innovation, essentially, around proteins, whether it's animal or vegetable proteins. And in the last few years, because of that super cluster, we've seen companies like Rocket out of Denmark. We've seen Nestle out of Switzerland. Many companies have actually invested in the region because they want to process more proteins in Canada. We have seen super clusters work very well in Canada. In fact, actually, I think the best one, the most successful super cluster we actually have in this country is run by a grocer. It's called President's Choice. President's Choice is by far, in my view, the best super cluster we have in the food space. The problem with President's Choice, it is a closed system and it's a private one only to benefit one company. So we need to recreate that model to support either other commodities or other, I would say, networks of companies.
If we anticipate reactions, though, you know, I think what's different about grocery, you know, in our work, we work with all different categories. If it's clothing, it's, you know, there's, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of clothing brands that you, that a individual shopper can access. And particularly retail channels, there's an abundance.
Well, I have three daughters. I can tell you there's too many brands for clothing. I can tell you right now.
and there's too many
That's
ways.
That's a scientific fact.
They can get it too many ways. But when I think of grocery, there's three really dominant behemoth players in Canada. And I'm kind of curious, in your mind, are they even stronger than before? And of course, we're talking about Loblaws, Sobeys, and Metro. And obviously, then you can go to Walmart and Costco. I mean, you can expand it a bit, but it's a very concentrated sector when you think of retail. Is that power even more concentrated coming out of COVID? And if so, if we're talking about sort of some disruptive forces, are they supportive of this? Are they, you know, is there a threat inherent to some of the big players or the big brands like Nestle?
Yeah, and I mean, there's, of course, because of COVID, there's a bit of a rapport de force between grocers and the national brands, the CPG companies, for sure. And there is this code of conduct discussion going on right now between grocers and processing. There's a tug of war right now going on in the sector. I think everyone knows that. I think I'm hopeful things will get resolved. We're supposed to be seeing a report coming out of Ottawa this month. I've actually had the pleasure to meet with the working group, who will be the group recommending to government exactly how this code should look like. I'm hoping that the government will actually play some sort of a role, or else I don't think it would work. Once that gets resolved, I actually think once there's a truce between grocers and CPG companies, I think we can move on and start thinking strategically about how we can grow the sector collaboratively in Canada over time.
Sylvain, I've got a question for you. So when you think about grocers today, a year ago, well, it's more than a year, 16 months ago, pre-pandemic, they were operating in one single way. What advantages did they gain other than, you know, because they became essential operators? Other than that, what advantages did they pick up on that they risk losing today as consumers come back?
I think, I think it boils down to social licensing. If you remember, George, it wasn't all a cakewalk for them last year. They were severely criticized for pulling the hero pay programs, for example, all at the same time. So there's a lot of that going on. And of course, the code of conduct situation is another one creeping up, because if, for example, if this working group decides to allow the industry to self-regulate, which is what Metro, Loblaws, and Walmart want, that's not going to go well with the Canadian public either, because they'll think again about the bread cartel story and the price fixing schemes that were going on for 14 years. I'm not sure Canadians have actually forgotten about that. They don't necessarily understand how it worked and who was involved, but they know that cartels are wrong, and so they're concerned about that. I actually think that grocers do have a bit of an image problem. And of course, with prices going up, which is why I think it is a major headwind for grocers, they'll be seen, I can guarantee it, George, they will be seen as gougers, because it's always, and I'm out there trying to explain to people why prices are going up, but they probably won't believe it. They'll just believe that grocers are just trying to get more money out of consumers who are vulnerable right now coming out of a pandemic. That to me is a huge problem.
Well, the other half of that is that if we are encouraging a homegrown Canadian food processing startups to scale, and if the whole culture is pay to play, and they're going up against you know, the big packaged goods guys who I guarantee are not going to want to give up an inch of shelf space. I can see that actually hindering what we all seem to want, which is buy local and
but incur- well, that's a great point, David. I mean, I've spoken to a few grocers in recent months, and I can tell you they're really trying very hard to sell local. They're going local as much as possible because they know they can work on that social licensing issue with consumers who are looking for. And frankly, I've been walking, I don't know about you guys, but I've been walking to some grocery stores and many local products are unbelievably affordable. They're well priced. They're not overpriced. They're not cheap, but they're priced appropriately well. And I've been impressed by, and every time I walk into a grocery store, that shelf of local products is almost empty by the end of the day. So I think they're doing it because they want to show to the public that they're supporting the entire supply chain from farm to fork.
So I wonder though, when you mentioned price, who buckles first, the consumer or the grocer that starts driving prices down? You know, does the consumer walk away first, and the grocers go panic and start driving prices down to compete? What's going to happen first?
Well, I mean, the easy answer for you, George, over the last, I would say, decade has been the grocer, because they've been bullying the supply chain for a very long time. Basically, grocers have seen themselves as the protector of citizens, really, when it comes to food affordability in Canada. In the U.S., it's not the same because you don't have an oligopoly in the U.S. You have many regional players distorting that those oligopolistic powers that you may find from Walmart or Kroger, or it's just not the same. In Canada, you basically have five major players dictating what we eat every single day. And so to get coordinated it's a very easy thing to do. So what has happened in the last 5-10 years, if Walmart was asked by, say, I don't know, General Mills, that they need to pay 10% more for their cereal or whatever they're trying to sell, they'll say, no way. And by the way, I need to charge you more fees because you're doing business with me. And if you don't deliver on time, I'll penalize you for it. And so Walmart was doing the bulldozing, and in behind them was Loblaw, Metro, and everyone else. That was going on and it got worse with COVID, which surprised me. I actually thought at the very beginning of COVID, people were working together. There was some harmony. They were helping each other out. Suppliers were helping grocers. It was really from March to May, I would say, it was beautiful. But in June, boom, Walmart comes in with new fees. Loblaw comes in with new fees. And that's when hell broke loose. And that's why it became this supply chain bullying situation became so public. It was out in the media. And frankly, George, I was shocked, completely shocked that it went to media, because it's such a unsexy, complicated topic for Canadians to understand. But it was out there and people got engaged. And so Walmart and Costco, not Costco, but Loblaws, had to listen. And that's why we're having this discussion around the code of conduct.
Well, and Michael Medline and Sobeys, either through pure doing good or brilliant strategy, knowing you're coming down the pipe, right? Let's get ahead of it. But that's done wonders, I think, to move this forward, to have someone of that size.
Michael Medline was brilliant because he broke ranks. Okay, let's be honest here. But he knew what he was doing. He's number two. He's not number one. He's number two. And of course, when you're number two, number one is typically not your friend. And I know you're recording this, and I don't care. They know what I think. And so it's competition, right? And so Sobeys and Michael, they've always they're always trying to find ways to be a good player. And frankly, over the last 5 years, they've become the more conscious of the industry, to be honest. Before it was Loblaws for the longest, with Galen Weston trying to set out a food policy for Canada, investing millions of dollars with Ottawa, changing things, protecting Canadians with food safety. I mean, the Westons invested heavily on policy. But over the last 5 years, I must say, Sobeys has had the upper hand on that moral, on that mold conscious that grocers would have with the Canadian public. And Michael Medline played to that narrative with at the Empire Club, saying, you know what, this supply chain bullying is too much. We need to stop. And so it forced the Retail Council of Canada, which Sobeys is a member of, along with Loblaws and Metro and Walmart, to say, okay, we have to look at this now. We can't just ignore it. And that's why they came up with their own proposal afterwards.
Deanne must have enjoyed that.
Because, you know what?
Because RCC really didn't have anything else going on for the last year and a half, did they?
Yeah. My first guest on my podcast would be Deanne in August. So be on the lookout for that. We recorded in May. She's great. But she's very forceful. I consider Deanne Brisebois as, I would say, probably the best leader in retail in Canada right now. She's doing a phenomenal job. She knows her thing. And she knew that when Michael actually came out at the Empire Club, she needed to do something.
Yeah, it played the hand, right? Well, you know, we talked about that five, right? The three or the five. Craig and the group were talking all the time, because in Craig's role as founder and editor of Retail Insider, there's always these stories that kind of lurk around Lidl and some of the Aldi and some of these other European giants.
Yep.
And whether or not they're going to come. And Craig, I don't know if you've been hearing anything recently, but you know, I think it's worth talking about that a little bit, that we may assume the competition is the competition, but maybe that's also going to be
I have a theory about that, but I'll let Craig talk a little bit.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is a couple of weeks ago, we got a reader from Montreal contacted us and said, look at all these job postings for Lidl in Canada. And of course, you know, my heart started to flutter and I thought it's finally happening. We're going to see this actually be a thing, because we reported a number of years ago on Aldi coming into Canada because there was some chatter around that. Which that article became viral. The grocers, of course, you know, Loblaws are terrified if, you know, an Aldi or a Lidl were to come into Canada. Loblaws had actually already created a concept called The Box, which was a very minimalist, low-priced grocery concept. But then when they bought Shoppers Drug Mart, I think it got rid of those plans, which perhaps it shouldn't have, because I think there is probably still room for this ultra-low-cost grocer out there. One of these two German ones, I guess, in particular, what they found is that the average basket size at an Aldi or a Lidl, I think Lidl they found just slightly cheaper, which wasn't the case before, was 40% less than what Walmart was in terms of groceries. So this is potentially incredibly disruptive. Now, these job postings that we saw turned out that it was just a mess up in some sort of algorithm online, and it just happens that the same towns in the UK have the same names as these communities in Ontario, and that it doesn't appear that it's coming to Canada just yet, but you know, it's going to be scary if it does. And Galen Weston had come out a few years ago and said, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
But yeah, I would say,
guys, before you move on, just for people that don't know about Aldi and Lidl, it may be a lower price, but the quality is very high. Mm-hmm. So this is a real moment of dissonance.
With a lot of organics, at least at Aldi. And that's quite shocking given the price point.
I lived in Europe for a year and I was a customer of both Lidl and Aldi. They're impressive retailers. I mean, there's no doubt. And they're both down south now. And we all know that they're looking at the Canadian market. But to be honest, the Canadian market is not overly attractive. That's why we have an oligopoly in Canada. Distribution costs are super high compared to the US. So they'll probably come in when they're ready. But I actually think that not enough attention is given to another player, a domestic player, who actually will be looking for some major growth. And that player is called Couche-Tard. I mean, Couche-Tard tried to buy Carrefour
yep.
a few months ago for a reason. That reason was, well, most of its business is dependent on that fuel to food conversion. They get people at their gas pumps only to come in after to buy some food. And the food actually that you find at Couche-Tard is actually not bad. It's not convenience store food. It's some products you can't even find in a grocery store. A lot of people don't know that, but that's been their business model. But guess what? With electric cars, who's going to come? Yep. Who's going to go to their convenience stores? And that's really the big struggle. That's what's keeping Couche-Tard up at night. They have 16,000 stores, and people don't realize it, but Couche-Tard was actually intended to buy Carrefour, which is actually, I think, three times larger than Loblaws. Okay. Yes. So, I mean, and if Couche-Tard is going to be sooner or later is going to be looking to become a grocer. And I believe they're probably be looking at Canada as a place to invest. And I don't know who they would buy. Probably not Loblaws. Probably not Sobeys. Maybe Metro. But yeah. I think there's something there going on that could happen over the next couple of years.
Oh, so I have a question. Just, you know, how does, we talked about the U.S. and, you know, I'm down in the U.S. living in Portland. And yes, like, I mean, there's so much variety. There's so many choices. And as consumers, we can kind of vote on those choices. And with the struggle in Canada with just, you know, the situation that you're talking about, how do consumers navigate that? Like, what becomes of the future state of Canada and how grocery is purchased? And will there be an opportunity for more collaboration? Or do we just see that this is just not going to happen and it's going to continue until, you know, some of the major players come in from outside and sort of force the situation? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say Amazon kind of did that in 2017 with the acquisition of Whole Foods. You felt in 2017 a disruption in Canada. All of a sudden, grocers start to feel, oh my God, Amazon is going into food now. They're going to be coming to Canada and they're going to be selling more food. And they wanted to do that. Amazon was pretty clear. But grocers really didn't convert all that much. They didn't pivot all that much at the time. They started, you saw that's when you saw the clicks and collects, and they weren't fully committed. COVID actually has forced grocers to commit to e-commerce a lot more, mm-hmm. a lot more. So they're getting ready for that Amazon invasion. I think Amazon is certainly a huge and legitimate threat for grocers, and that's why grocers are becoming more multi-platform grocers as a result of what's happening with Amazon, because Amazon is so successful. It's unbelievable what they can do.
So Sylvain, what would you say the percentage of groceries that will be bought and ordered online versus what it is today in 5 years?
In Canada?
Yeah, in Canada.
I don't think Canada will catch up to the U.S., but it will get closer for sure. So these are only estimates that we have. So before COVID, about 1.7% of all the food sold retail was sold online in Canada. That was before COVID. Now we're at about, this is our estimate, we're at about 4% now. The U.S., I believe, and perhaps Christine has some numbers, we believe that U.S. is over 7 right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's just, I think it's just been more accepted. And then you have, you know, the Instacarts and everything else. So it if they couldn't go direct to the grocery store, there's 3 or 4 different options of ways for you to get your groceries, you know, delivered to your door or, you know, kind of brought out to your car. So there's a lot more, I think, openness to a variety of different ways to get your groceries here. Back to this point of variety, there's lots of options. So if you're not happy with the quality, the service, et cetera. There's so many different places that you can go to. And the local focus, I think, is really, really big here. Everyone's really focused on it, trying to get as much product that they can from local sources. It's marketed and advertised a lot more, fresh fruits, meats, vegetables, et cetera. So, I mean, granted, the U.S. is significantly larger than Canada, and so the ability to get that product is a little bit different. But I feel like there's just an embracing of a different paradigm here, where it's just, you know, we're shopping in different situations, we're getting our food in different places, and we're open to directly doing it online, to picking it up, to going back into the stores again to get our products.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the game market is, I think, severely underserved as a result of the oligopoly. And I don't want to take anything away from the grocers that we have in Canada, but there's lack of competition, basically. And yeah. I think that Amazon is making them work harder for their business. The aftermath of COVID will actually force them to work harder for their business too.
I was going to say the same thing. Sorry, David. Yes, I was just going to say the same thing. There's, if you're happy, a friend of mine calls it fat, dumb, and happy. What's the point, right? You don't have to do anything, right? And back to Christine's point about being more online, being more accepted in the U.S. But I think online would be more accepted in Canada if it was more available in Canada. You know, I just don't see grocers investing in this as broadly as being invested in the U.S. And you know, so consumer options are less. At least that's my perception of it. And because as a shopper in grocery stores, I have no loyalty, right? And we're running a poll just asking consumers about their spending behaviors and everything. 35% of them are telling us that they're more into their spending behavior has been driven by price.
So, to see innovation, you need to see a paradigm shift. What has happened with grocers is that before, they only saw e-commerce as a threat, cannibalism, essentially. They actually sincerely believed that they weren't providing value to the consumer. They were only sacrificing bricks and mortar sales for another channel. And they never saw any value. Now they're starting to understand, once you start listening to the market, that's when you can innovate and start figuring out how you can make more money by doing other things. That's what has happened in the U.S. and it's starting to happen in Canada now.
What I was trying to get at a moment ago was, when we average everything together and we have a stat and it covers a topic, we're seeing grocery, my mind goes to produce, meats, and those sorts of things. But what gets sold in a typical supermarket is far more than that. And so you got your paper towel, your cleaners, your consumables, right? So I wonder how much there's going to be a bifurcation of these two classes, at least. The foods that have a fresh aspect to them, are they going to be as in demand via e-com? I certainly think that what the pandemic taught us was to buy your weeklies that come in, your paper towels and such. You can just put that on a replenishment cycle. But I'm curious about that. And I'm also curious about the differences regionally, because I think what's different about the States and why, George, there's more demand there and more supply is, if you take a city like LA or New York, 10 million, whatever, plus people, densely crowded, you can deliver things. You can have a really viable economic model that can deliver stuff to them easily. And meanwhile, they may not be able to drive around like you could in Milton or...
Well, but I live rural and voila, will deliver to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you right now, like most people, like if you live in a community where you've got three functioning grocery stores all within a 10-minute drive and there's no traffic, at the end of the day, are you making a big convenience play there? But I certainly know, like when you looked at e-com, it was coming out of Seoul and Tokyo and places like that where it was solving real, real problems, you know?
I must say, I'm quite concerned for grocery chains or grocery stores located in urban centers.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, there are a lot of problems on the horizon. One, we talked about already, the workforce, people, where are they going to be working? A lot of them will be working from home on a part-time, full-time basis. The other thing that we haven't talked about is our population. Now, I don't know what the numbers are in the U.S., but if you look at StatsCan's numbers recently, I mean, they've said two things. Immigration is way down because of COVID. We actually missed our target by 200,000 people last year. That's Guelph and plus. I mean, that's a lot of people. And we're actually looking at missing our target again this year. Our birth rate is likely to drop by 0.2 by 2026. Right now in Canada, it's at 1.71, okay, which is not 2.1, which is enough to replace yourself. But we had immigration. So we were good, but immigration is down. Our birth rate is going to drop by 0.2%. Why? Well, look at universities, look at young professionals. Their careers have been delayed by COVID when you think about it. I mean, all of the kids that were planning to start a career, where they put their time, their life on hold for a while until we deal with this virus to go back to work. They're not going to start a family right away. They're going to wait a while. And so those are things that are happening right now, which will impact the number of mouths we're going to be feeding in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, and all of these people typically would live downtowns, would spend money downtown. And if you don't have that those people in downtown cores, that's going to be a problem for them.
Well, and finally, as the borders open up, I mean, you have tourism too, right? And yeah. Canada has been a huge destination. And, you know, as a Canadian citizen, as of yesterday, I'm finally able to come and travel up there without having to do a COVID test. But Americans are still not able to come into the country, and nor a lot of other people. So, you know, that's another little factor there, I think,
because
you think about all the people that come from a tourist perspective to try the restaurants, the food, to see the culture of Canada. It's fascinating. That's an interesting aspect of it.
The tourism is a factor for grocers, but not as much as food service. Yeah.
No, for sure.
But for restaurants, hey.
Well, and the restaurant thing, I think, is really intriguing to me. So we talked about that earlier.
Yeah,
I think we're seeing a lot of that in the U.S. I think local stores offering, you know, food to go or an opportunity to come and sit and eat. Granted, with COVID, that sort of shut down, but it's starting to sort of open up again and people are more comfortable going in there. And I think it's like quality of the food and what they can get in a store. And there's the convenience of popping in there and grabbing lunch or having a quick bite tea as you're running on to do your other errands.
To the restaurant point, I mean, I actually do think that grocers after COVID will be desperate for growth for a variety of reasons. We've mentioned pretty much all of them now. I think they're going to be looking for some options. They'll try to become more versatile for the marketplace. They'll become greenhouses, farms, restaurants. I mean, they'll try to empower gardeners. They'll try to empower gourmets. They'll try to empower cooks. They'll try to empower a bunch of people all under one roof. What I'm seeing right now are grocers signing deals with companies which can bring in a store, a greenhouse, a miniature greenhouse. Sobeys is doing it right now at a company out of Germany. You can just walk in and buy your spices, your different products fresh, or you can buy the plant to bring home. So it's really fascinating what's happening. And what's more local than buying your own tomato plant at the grocery store? You know, it's...
Well, and growing it, right? I mean, I've seen a lot of that here where it's just... It's flooded with people trying to do their own little gardens, or there's a really cool company that you can grow lettuce and stuff in a pod. Like it's a plastic pod that you can keep in your house and you can grow fruits and vegetables and things like that. And
There's a store. We were there just this afternoon with the family. It's called Avril, A-V-R-I-L. It's only in Quebec. You walk in into the Laval facility. It's a grocery store, a little overpriced still, but you can see through the roof a vertical farm growing the things that you're buying in the store. It's incredible. Incredible. Yeah.
So, Van, that's what we didn't touch on, though, which is with all these, you know, the oligopoly model, is there room for independent, clever independence in either niches like fishmongers or in some kind of innovative concept to carve out their place in all of this?
Well, there's a reason why Farm Boy sold in 2018 and Longo's just recently was acquired by Sobeys. And I assume that, George, you were a customer of Grocery Gateway, perhaps before Voila, maybe, yep. Maybe not. Yeah. And so you were converted into a Voila by Sobeys customer because of the fact that independent grocers are severely under pressure. And it actually is linked to the supply chain bullying we were talking about earlier. When you think about it, if Walmart and Sobeys can negotiate a better prices and get higher fees from suppliers, well, the independents can't do that. They're not powerful enough. So they actually deal with UGI, the United Group, the buyers group, to get good deals, but they're not nearly as good as what Walmart and Loblaws and perhaps to a certain extent Sobeys are getting right now. And that's why, unfortunately, if there is no code implemented in Canada, I would probably see the disappearance of several independent grocers, because right now the marketplace, and that's why when we talk about Aldi and Lidl coming in, I always laugh a little bit because I see all these independents closing every week or being bought out, because it's a tough market. Canada is a tough market. You got 38 million people in one of the largest countries in the world. It's really tough business to be a grocer here.
And I guess the number of people that want some fresh seafood, you know, versus they'll settle, they have a family and they're busy and they'll take the frozen stuff from Loblaws. It's not enough maybe to make other options viable.
Yeah. So I'm very concerned. I'm actually, you see, the thing about independent grocers and a lot of Canadians, I think, underappreciate how valuable they are. Most of the innovation we've seen in the grocery business have come from independent grocers. Grocery Gateway, good example. I mean, in 2004, Longo's decided to invest in Grocery Gateway just to differentiate itself. And look at it. They were pioneers, and now they were bought up by Sobeys. Many products were given a shot by independents when other major chains were just not even looking. And Arlene Dickinson, with whom I actually work with District Ventures in Calgary, I used to fly in once in a while there before COVID to help startups there. Now I Zoom in to talk to startups. But she actually believes in independence as well very much. Yeah. In fact, with District Ventures in Calgary, if you have a marketable product to do run pilots, you can actually deal with some grocers in Calgary. And all of them are independents, which is great. And without them, it would be very hard for startups to actually have a shot and understand how the market can react to a product.
You know, I'm only half kidding when I say this, but I'm going to say it carefully. How long before there's a drive-through at a Loblaws or anywhere else and I see a President's Choice burger on the menu board at the drive-through? You know, I'm just curious because, you know, the whole grocerant idea, I mean, why wouldn't you be doing this? Mm-hmm. You know, what's to stop them, right? I mean, if you have this kind of monopoly, and it is, you know, you've got so much control in the marketplace, you can almost own every aspect of food. You know, and that's what I'm picking up on here. And the small guys, you know, they've got a tough road ahead of them. Challenging, you know, because there's opportunities, but at the same time, unless you've got deep pockets and you can afford to, put food in a store and make it affordable to consumers, you price yourself out of the market.
Why would you even have home meal prep kits that are third party? That should be owned by, you know, it'll be bought out eventually.
Again, that blurring line between service and retail, grocers will actually have to get rid of that line. So COVID got rid of that line, really. And I think grocers will want to keep it that way because they'll make money. And so they can play around. The supply chain is much more democratic. It's much more open now. There are new rules. In fact, there are no rules. And so grocers, it's grocers' game to lose, really. If they don't really take advantage of the fact that there are no rules, they're going to lose big time.
Yeah, because they're under some pressure. I keep catching snippets in the press about the comp stores, the old KPI that people in retail seem to still cling on to. If year on year, 2019, 2020 was up 10% plus, and now we're in 2021, the restaurants will start to open up. We will see that transition of people from buying lots of stuff, putting it in their pantry, cooking at home, to actually going out and enjoying restaurant meals once again. The big grocers are going to be under huge pressure to find, the magic juice, the magic sauce to actually keep that level of turnover. But if it was that easy, they'd already been doing it. So the only route is either to basically steal it from the independents or steal it from each other. Mm-hmm. To the point you made earlier on, the e-commerce was in their mind was cannibalization of their own store sales. But maybe e-commerce might be a way of stealing stuff from the other two or four, depending on which one you want to look at.
Ironically, if you have to pick one player who hasn't done a good job with e-commerce, it's Loblaw. I mean, the number one grocer in Canada, it's still relying on click and collect. And let's face it, the click and collect model serves the grocer well. It gives an option to consumers, but it doesn't offer a package. It doesn't really offer a portfolio of options for consumers. It's convenient for grocers mostly.
It is and it isn't, in the sense of one of the big issues I have with grocers doing, or any retailer doing, click and collect is their measure of availability or in stockness, first time accession, is actually put out onto the internet and say, here's my range, here's my assortment, what do you want? And they come in, and the first thing they do is, we're out of stock, so we give a substitute. So the idea of click and collect was to utilize the stock in the store. It's very close to the market. Great idea. But until grocers and other retailers solve their in-stock accuracy problem and allow that to go up to the internet so the customer can have reassurance that when they place their order, they're going to get 100% of their order. There's so much to do. So click and collect is a double-edged sword. Sometimes it can offer that convenience, especially when we're in lockdown, when a trip to the local Loblaws, Sobeys, or whatever Loblaws or Metro, I guess, was a day out. It's something to look forward to. We're going to do a click and collect, but
I've always seen the click and collect model to change the color of your car. You're not changing models. It's just the same car in a different color. That's really what it is. Yeah. And there's no effort to really think differently about the consumer, about the product, how it's marketed. You just see a bunch of people walking around with baskets in the store, filling out an order that was given online, waiting for that person to spend the gas, spend the time to come up and pick up whatever they ordered.
And the only way to solve this stock accuracy problem is to actually go to a micro-fulfillment center where you keep the stock actually outside the store. You keep it in the back room, effectively. When the customer order comes in, there's much higher probability that is actually available and can be picked 100%. But while we have the vagaries of low levels of stock accuracy, the last thing we really want to be doing is putting it on the internet and allowing the customer to get very disappointed very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. But the Metro model and Voila by Sobeys, to me, that's a commitment. That's a commitment. And it would only, I mean, they can fulfill an order of 50 items within 5-7 minutes. Mm. No humans touching. Do you know what it means during COVID? No humans touching.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah. Up the freezer.
Yeah. Manually pick the freezer. A bunch of dishwashers basically roaming around a huge warehouse filling out orders. No human touch, zero. It's perfect for people who are scared to death of the virus.
And it'd be awesome if they actually milked the cow, you know.
Right there. I mean, you know what, Sylvain? Even germaphobes, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I mean, forget the pandemic at this point. Even germaphobes.
Yeah.
You don't want anybody to touch your vegetables other than you. Yeah. Right.
Oh yeah. No. Absolutely. Yeah.
On that,
George, you wash them in the shower anyway, so I don't.
No, I did see a guy at a grocery store moving fruit from one box to another and repackaging, and I said I realized it wasn't an employee.
It was probably me. So. So Van, this has been a great. Chat, and you know, I think we gotta do an update one of these down the road, because it's so it's important from a retail strategy point of view, but it's also so important to Canadian, you know, self-sufficiency generally, and just feeding our communities is so kind of vital compared to some of the other topics we get into.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we deserve the grocery business we have. I mean, that's basic, because as Christine said, we vote with our money, but we haven't really, as Canadians, we haven't given the grocery business a whole lot of thought. We just show up at the grocery store. We just accept what's there. And we think that Cheese Whiz is actually cheese running out there.
On that note, I just want to kind of wrap this up and thank everybody for tuning in. So we have our special guest, Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, the food professor. We have David Ian Gray, Christine Cowan, Craig Patterson, George Minakakis, and Gary Newbury, me, wishing you all well. And make sure you sign on and subscribe to our channel on whichever podcast or video platform that you're listening to us. Don't miss an episode. They're brilliant. Thank you, everybody.
You have been listening to the Business of Retail podcast, an unflinching strategic alternative to the conventional industry discourse. Thank you for joining us. For more information, please go to www.thebusinessofretail.ca.